This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Written in My Own Heart's Blood by Diana Gabaldon. Narrated by Davina Porter and directed by Kathleen Gormley.
Prologue. In the light of eternity, time casts no shadow. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. But what is it that the old women see? We see necessity, and we do the things that must be done. Young women don't see. They are, and the spring of life runs through them. Ours is the guarding of the spring. Ours the shielding of the light we have lit, the flame that we are. What have I seen? You are the vision of my youth, the constant dream of all my ages. Here I stand on the brink of war again, a citizen of no place, no time, no country but my own. And that a land lapped by no sea but blood, bordered only by the outlines of a face long loved. Part 1. Nexus. Chapter 1. A Hundredweight of Stones. June 16, 1778. The forest between Philadelphia and Valley Forge. Ian Murray stood with a stone in his hand, eyeing the ground he'd chosen. A small clearing, out of the way, up among a scatter of great lichened boulders, under the shadow of firs, and at the foot of a big red cedar. A place where no casual passer-by would go, but not inaccessible. He meant to bring them up here. The family. Fergus, to begin with. Maybe just Fergus by himself. Mam had raised Fergus from the time he was 10, and he'd had no mother before that. Fergus had known Mam longer than Ian had, and loved her as much. Maybe more, he thought, his grief aggravated by guilt. Fergus had stayed with her at Lallybroch, helped to take care of her, and the place. He hadn't. He swallowed hard, and walking into the small, clear space, set his stone in the middle, then stood back to look. Even as he did so, he found himself shaking his head. No, it had to be two cairns. His mam and Uncle Jamie were brother and sister, and the family could mourn them here together. But there were others he might bring, maybe, to remember and pay their respects. And those were the folk who would have known Jamie Fraser and loved him well, but wouldn't have kenned Jenny Murray from a hole in the... The image of his mother in a hole in the ground stabbed him like a fork, retreated with the recollection that she wasn't, after all, in a grave, and stabbed again all the harder for that. He really couldn't bear the vision of them drowning, maybe clinging to each other, struggling to keep... Aye-ya, he said violently. And dropped the stone, turning back at once to find more. He'd seen people drown. Tears ran down his face with the sweat of the summer day. He didn't mind it, only stopping now and then to wipe his nose on his sleeve. He tied a rolled kerchief round his head to keep the hair and the stinging sweat out of his eyes. It was sopping before he'd added more than 20 stones to each of the cairns. He and his brothers had built a fine cairn for their father at the head of the carved stone that bore his name, all his names, in spite of the expense, in the burying ground at Lallybroch. And then, later, at the funeral, members of the family, followed by the tenants and then the servants, had come one by one to add a stone each to the weight of remembrance. Fergus, then. Or... No. What was he thinking? Auntie Clare must be the first he brought here. She wasn't Scots herself, but she can't find what a cairn was, and would maybe be comforted a bit to see Uncle Jamie's. Aye. Right. Auntie Clare. Then Fergus. Uncle Jamie was Fergus's foster father. He had a right. And then maybe Marsali and the children. But maybe Germaine was old enough to come with Fergus. He was 10, near enough to being a man to understand, to be treated like a man. And Uncle Jamie was his grandsire. It was proper. He stepped back again and wiped his face, breathing heavily. Bugs whined and buzzed past his ears and hovered over him, wanting his blood. But he'd stripped to a loincloth and rubbed himself with bear grease and mint in the Mohawk way. They didn't touch him.
"Look over them, O Spirit of Red Cedar," he said softly in Mohawk, gazing up into the fragrant branches of the tree. "Guard their souls and keep their presence here fresh as thy branches."
He crossed himself and bent to dig about in the soft leaf mould. A few more rocks, he thought, in case they might be scattered by some passing animal. Scattered like his thoughts, which roamed restless to and fro among the faces of his family, the folk of the ridge.
God, might he ever go back there? Brianna. Oh, Jesus, Brianna.
He bit his lip and tasted salt, licked it away and moved on foraging.
She was safe with Roger Mack and the Waynes. But Jesus, he could have used her advice. Even more, Roger Mack's.
Who was left for him to ask if he needed help in taking care of them all? Thought of Rachel came to him, and the tightness in his chest eased a little.
Aye, if he had Rachel. She was younger than him, nay more than 19, and being a Quaker, had very strange notions of how things should be. But if he had her, he'd have solid rock under his feet.
He hoped he would have her, but there were still things he must say to her, and the thought of that conversation made the tightness in his chest come back. The picture of his cousin Brianna came back, too, and lingered in his mind, tall, long-nosed, and strong-boned as her father. And with it rose the image of his other cousin, Bree's half-brother.
Holy God, William.
And what ought he to do about William?
He doubted the man kent the truth, kent that he was Jamie Fraser's son. Was it Ian's responsibility to tell him so? To bring him here and explain what he'd lost?
He must have groaned at the thought, for his dog, Rollo, lifted his massive head and looked at him in concern.
"No, I dinna ken that either," Ian told him. "Let it bide, aye?"
Rollo laid his head back on his paws, shivered his shaggy hide against the flies, and relaxed in boneless peace. Ian worked a while longer and let the thoughts drain away with his sweat and his tears. He finally stopped when the sinking sun touched the tops of his cairns, feeling tired but more at peace. The cairns rose knee-high, side by side, small but solid. He stood still for a bit, not thinking any more, just listening to the fussing of wee birds in the grass and the breathing of the wind among the trees. Then he sighed deeply, squatted, and touched one of the cairns. He said softly,
"My love is upon you, mother."
Closed his eyes and laid a scuffed hand on the other heap of stones. The dirt ground into his skin made his fingers feel strange, as though he could maybe reach straight through the earth and touch what he needed. He stayed still, breathing, then opened his eyes.
"Help me with this, Uncle Jamie," he said. "I dinna think I can manage alone."
Chapter 2. Dirty Bastard. William Ransom, 9th Earl of Ellesmere, Viscount Ashness, Baron Derwent, shoved his way through the crowds on Market Street, oblivious to the complaints of those rebounding from his impact. He didn't know where he was going or what he might do when he got there. All he knew was that he'd burst if he stood still. His head throbbed like an inflamed boil. Everything throbbed. His hand, he'd probably broken something, but he didn't care. His heart, pounding and sore inside his chest. His foot, for God's sake, what, did he kick something? He lashed out viciously at a loose cobblestone and sent it rocketing through a crowd of geese, who set up a huge cackle and lunged at him, hissing and beating at his shins with their wings. Feathers and goose shit flew wide, and the crowd scattered in all directions. bastard!" shrieked the goose girl, and struck at him with her crook, catching him a shrewd thump on the ear. "Devil take you, Dreckiger bastard!" This sentiment was echoed by a number of other angry voices, and he veered into an alley pursued by shouts and honks of agitation. He rubbed his throbbing ear, lurching into buildings as he passed, oblivious to everything but the one word throbbing ever louder in his head. Bastard. Bastard, he said out loud, and shouted, bastard, 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 at the top of his lungs, hammering at the brick wall next to him with a clenched fist.
Who's a bastard? Said a curious voice behind him.
He swung round to see a young woman looking at him with some interest. Her eyes moved slowly down his frame, taking note of the heaving chest, the blood stains on the facings of his uniform coat, and the green smears of goose shit on his breeches. Her gaze reached his silver-buckled shoes and returned to his face with more interest.
I am, he said, hoarse and bitter.
Oh, really?
She left the shelter of the doorway in which she'd been lingering and came across the alley to stand right in front of him. She was tall and slim, and had a very fine pair of high young breasts which were clearly visible under the thin muslin of her shift, because, while she had a silk petticoat, she wore no stays. No cap, either. Her hair fell loose over her shoulders. A whore.
I'm partial to bastards myself, she said,
and touched him lightly on the arm.
What kind of bastard are you?
A wicked one. An evil one?
A sorry one, he said,
and scowled when she laughed. She saw the scowl, but didn't pull back.
Come in, she said, and took his hand. You look as though you could do with a drink.
He saw her glance at his knuckles, burst and bleeding, and she caught her lower lip behind small white teeth. She didn't seem afraid, though, and he found himself drawn, unprotesting, into the shadowed doorway after her.
What did it matter,
he thought, with a sudden savage weariness.
What did anything matter?
Chapter 3. In which the women, as usual, pick up the pieces. Number 17, Chestnut Street, Philadelphia. The residence of Lord and Lady John Grey. William had left the house, like a thunderclap, and the place looked as though it had been struck by lightning. I certainly felt like the survivor of a massive electrical storm, hairs and nerve endings all standing up, straight on end, waving in agitation. Jenny Murray had entered the house on the heels of William's departure, and while the sight of her was a lesser shock than any of the others so far, it still left me speechless. I goggled at my erstwhile sister-in-law. Though, come to think, she still was my sister-in-law. Because Jamie was alive. Alive! He'd been in my arms not 10 minutes before, and the memory of his touch flickered through me like lightning in a bottle. I was dimly aware that I was smiling like a loon, despite massive destruction, horrific scenes. William's distress, if you could call an explosion like that distress. Jamie's danger. And a faint wonder as to what either Jenny or Mrs. Fig, Lord John's cook and housekeeper, might be about to say. Mrs. Fig was smoothly spherical, gleamingly black, and inclined to glide silently up behind one like a menacing ball bearing.
"What's this?"
she barked, manifesting herself suddenly behind Jenny.
"Holy Mother of God!"
Jenny whirled, eyes round and hand pressed to her chest. "Who in God's name are you?"
"This is Mrs. Fig," I said,
feeling a surreal urge to laugh, despite, or maybe because of, recent events. "Lord John Grey's cook. And Mrs. Fig, this is Mrs. Murray, my...
"Your good sister," Jenny said firmly.
She raised one black eyebrow.
"If you'll have me still."
Her look was straight and open, and the urge to laugh changed abruptly into an equally strong urge to burst into tears. Of all the unlikely sources of succour I could have imagined, I took a deep breath and put out my hand.
I'll have you.
We hadn't parted on good terms in Scotland, but I'd loved her very much once, and wasn't about to pass up any opportunity to mend things. Her small, firm fingers wove through mine, squeezed hard, and as simply as that, it was done. No need for apologies or spoken forgiveness. She'd never had to wear the mask that Jamie did. What she thought and felt was there in her eyes, those slanted blue cat eyes she shared with her brother. She knew the truth now of what I was, and she knew I loved, and always had loved, her brother with all my heart and soul, despite the minor complications of my being presently married to someone else. She heaved a sigh, eyes closing for an instant, then opened them and smiled at me, mouth trembling only a little.
"Well, fine and dandy," said Mrs. Fig shortly.
She narrowed her eyes and rotated smoothly on her axis, taking in the panorama of destruction. The railing at the top of the stairs had been ripped off, and cracked banisters, dented walls, and bloody smudges marked the path of William's descent. Shattered crystals from the chandelier littered the floor, glinting festively in the light that poured through the open front door. The door itself cracked through, and hanging drunkenly from one hinge.
"Merde en toast," Mrs. Fig murmured.
She turned abruptly to me, her small blackcurrant eyes still narrowed.
"Where's his lordship?"
"Ah," I said. This was going to be rather sticky, I saw. While deeply disapproving of most people, Mrs. Fig was devoted to John. She wasn't going to be at all pleased to hear that he'd been abducted by... "For that matter, where's my brother?" Jenny inquired, glancing round as though expecting Jamie to appear suddenly out from under the settee.
"Oh," I said.
Well,
possibly worse than sticky, because...
"And where's my sweet William?" Mrs. Fig demanded, sniffing the air.
"He's been here. I smell that stinky cologne he puts on his linen."
She nudged a dislodged chunk of plaster disapprovingly with the toe of her shoe. I took another long, deep breath and a tight grip on what remained of my sanity.
"Mrs. Fig," I said, "perhaps you would be so kind as to make us all a cup of tea?"
We sat in the parlour while Mrs. Fig came and went to the cookhouse, keeping an eye on her terrapin stew.
"You don't want a scorched turtle? No, you don't," she said severely to us, setting down the teapot in its padded yellow cosy on her return. "Not with so much sherry as his lordship likes in it. Almost a full bottle. Terrible waste of good liquor that would be."
My insides turned over promptly. Turtle soup, with a lot of sherry, had certain strong and private associations for me, these being connected with Jamie, feverish delirium, and the way in which a heaving ship assists sexual intercourse. Contemplation of which would not assist the impending discussion in the slightest. I rubbed a finger between my brows in hopes of dispelling the buzzing cloud of confusion gathering there. The air in the house still felt electric.
"Speaking of sherry," I said, "or any other sort of strong spirit you might have convenient, Mrs. Fig."
She looked thoughtfully at me, nodded, and reached for the decanter on the sideboard.
"Brandy is stronger," she said,
and set it in front of me. Jenny looked at me with the same thoughtfulness, and reaching out, poured a good-sized slug of the brandy into my cup, then a similar one into her own. "Just in case," she said, raising one brow, and we drank for a few moments. I thought it might take something stronger than brandy-laced tea to deal with the effect of recent events on my nerves.
Laudanum, say, or a large slug of straight Scotch whisky.
But the tea undeniably helped, hot and aromatic, settling in a soft, trickling warmth amidships.
"So then, we're fettled, are we?"
Jenny set down her own cup and looked expectant.
"It's a start."
I took a deep breath and gave her a précis of the morning's events. Jenny's eyes were disturbingly like Jamie's. She blinked at me once, then twice, and shook her head as though to clear it, accepting what I'd just told her.
So Jamie's gone off with your Lord John, the British Army's after them, the tall lad I met on the stoop with steam coming out of his ears is Jamie's son. Well, of course he is. A blind man could see that. And the town's aboil with British soldiers. Is that it, then?
He's not exactly my Lord John, I said. But yes, that's essentially the position. I take it Jamie told you about William, then?
Aye, he did.
She grinned at me over the rim of her teacup.
I'm that happy for him. What was troubling his lad, then? He looked like he wouldn't give the road to a bear. What did you say?
Mrs. Figg's voice cut in abruptly. She set down the tray she had just brought in, the silver milk jug and sugar basin rattling like castanets.
William is whose son?
I took a fortifying gulp of tea. Mrs. Figg did know that I'd been married to, and theoretically widowed from, one James Fraser, but that was all she knew.
Well, I said, and paused to clear my throat. The, tall gentleman with the red hair who was just here, you saw him?
I did.
Mrs. Figg eyed me narrowly.
Did you get a good look at him?
Didn't pay much heed to his face when he came to the door and asked where you were. But I saw his backside pretty plain when he pushed past me and ran up the stairs.
Possibly the resemblance is less marked from that angle. I took another mouthful of tea. That gentleman is James Fraser, my... First husband wasn't accurate, and neither was last husband, or even, unfortunately, most recent husband. I settled for the simplest alternative. My husband and, William's father. Mrs. Figg's mouth opened, soundless for an instant. She backed up slowly and sat down on a needlework ottoman with a soft thump.
William know that? She asked, after a moment's contemplation.
He does now, I said,
with a brief gesture towards the devastation in the stairwell, clearly visible through the door of the parlour where we were sitting.
Made on... I mean, holy lamb of God preserve us.
Mrs. Figg's second husband was a Methodist preacher, and she strove to be a credit to him. But her first had been a French gambler. Her eyes fixed on me like gun sights.
You is mother?
I choked on my tea. No, I said, wiping my chin with a linen napkin. It isn't quite that complicated. In fact, it was more so. But I wasn't going to explain just how Willie had come about, either to Mrs. Figg or to Jenny. Jamie had to have told Jenny who William's mother was. But I doubted that he'd told his sister that William's mother, Geneva Dunsany, had forced him into her bed by threatening Jenny's family. No man of spirit likes to admit that he's been effectively blackmailed by an 18-year-old girl. Lord John became William's legal guardian when William's grandfather died, and at that point Lord John also married Lady Isabel Dunsany, Willie's mother's sister. She'd looked after Willie since his mother's death in childbirth, and she and Lord John were essentially Willie's parents since he was quite young. Isabel died when he was 11 or so. Mrs. Figg took this explanation in stride, but wasn't about to be distracted from the main point at issue.
James Fraser, she said,
tapping a couple of broad fingers on her knee and looking accusingly at Jenny.
How comes he not to be dead? News was he drowned.
She cut her eyes at me.
I thought his lordship was like to throw himself in the harbour too when he heard it.
I closed my own eyes with a sudden shudder, the salt-cold horror of that news washing over me in a wave of memory. Even with Jamie's touch still joyful on my skin, and the knowledge of him glowing in my heart, I relived the crushing pain of hearing that he was dead.
Well, I can enlighten ye on that point, at least.
I open my eyes to see Jenny drop a lump of sugar into her fresh tea and nod at Mrs. Fig. We were to take passage on a ship called Euterpe, my brother and myself, out abreast. But the black-hearted thief of a captain sailed without us.
Much good it did him, she added, frowning.
Much good indeed. The Euterpe had sunk in a storm in the Atlantic, lost with all hands, as I and John Gray had been told. Jamie found us another ship, but it landed us in Virginia, and we'd to make our way up the coast, partly by wagon, partly by packet boat, keeping out of the way of the soldiers.
Those wee needles you gave Jamie against the seasickness work a marvel, she added, turning approvingly to me. He showed me how to put them in for him.
But when we came to Philadelphia yesterday, she went on, returning to her tale, we stole into the city by night like a pair of thieves, and made our way to Fergus's print shop.
Lord, I thought my heart would stop a dozen times.
She smiled at the memory, and I was struck by the change in her. The shadow of sorrow still lay on her face, and she was thin and worn by travel. But the terrible strain of her husband Ian's long dying had lifted. There was colour in her cheeks again, and a brightness in her eyes that I hadn't seen since I had first known her 30 years before. She had found her peace, I thought, and felt a thankfulness that eased my own soul.
So, Jamie taps on the door at the back, and there's no answer, though we can see the light of a fire coming through the shutters.
He knocks again, making a wee tune of it. She rapped her knuckles lightly on the table. Ba-da-bum-ba-ba-bum-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum. And my heart turned over, recognizing the theme from the Lone Ranger, which Brianna had taught him.
And after a moment, Jenny went on, a woman's voice calls out fierce, "Who's there?" And Jamie says, in the Gaelic, "It is your father, my daughter, and a cold, wet, and hungry man he is too. For it was raining hammer handles and pitchforks, and we were both soaked to the skin."
She rocked back a little, enjoying the telling.
"The door opens then, just a crack. And there's Miss Sally wi' a horse pistol in her hand, and her two wee lasses behind her, fierce as archangels, each with a billet of wood ready to crack a thief across his shins."
They see the firelight shine on Jamie's face then, and all three of them let out skellachs like to wake the dead, and fall upon him, and drag him inside, all talking at once, and greeting, asking, was he a ghost, and why was he not drowned? And that was the first we learned that the Euterpe had sunk.
She crossed herself. "God rest them poor souls," she said, shaking her head. I crossed myself too, and saw Mrs. Fig look sideways at me. She hadn't realized I was a papist. "I've come in too, of course," Jenny went on, "but everyone's talking at once and rushing to and fro in search of dry clothes and hot drinks. And I'm just looking about the place, for I've never been inside a print shop before, and the smell of the ink and the paper and lead is a wonder to me."
And sudden like there's a tug on my skirt, and this sweet-faced wee manny says to me, "And who are you, madam? Would you like some cider?"
"Henri Christian," I murmured, smiling at the thought of Masali's youngest,
and Jenny nodded.
"Why, I'm your Granny Janet's son," says I, and his eyes go round and he lets out a shriek and grabs me round the legs and gives me such a hug as to make me lose my balance and fall down on the settle.
"Have a bruise on my bum the size of your hand,"
she added out of the corner of her mouth to me. I felt a small knot of tension that I hadn't realized was there relax. Jenny did, of course, know that Henri Christian had been born a dwarf, but knowing and seeing are sometimes different things. Clearly, they hadn't been for Jenny. Mrs. Fig had been following this account with interest, but maintained her reserve. At the mention of the print shop, though, this reserve hardened a bit.
"These folk. Masali is your daughter, then, ma'am?"
I could tell what she was thinking. The entire town of Philadelphia knew that Jamie was a rebel, and by extension, so was I. It was the threat of my imminent arrest that had caused John to insist upon my marrying him in the wake of the tumult following Jamie's presumed death. The mention of printing in British-occupied Philadelphia was bound to raise questions as to just what was being printed, and by whom. No, her husband is my brother's adopted son, Jenny explained. But I raised Fergus from a wee lad myself, so he's my foster son as well, by the Highland way of reckoning. Mrs. Fig blinked. She had been gamely trying to keep the cast of characters in some sort of order to this point, but now gave it up with a shake of her head that made the pink ribbons on her cap wave like antennae.
Well, where the devil, I mean, where on earth has your brother gone with his lordship? She demanded. To this print shop, you think?
Jenny and I exchanged glances.
I doubt it, I said. More likely he's gone outside the city, using John, his lordship, I mean, as a hostage to get past the pickets, if necessary. Probably he'll let him go as soon as they're far enough away for safety.
Mrs. Fig made a deep humming noise of disapproval.
And maybe he'll make for Valley Forge and turn him over to the rebels instead.
Oh, I shouldn't have think so, Jenny said soothingly. What would they want with him, after all? Mrs. Fig blinked again, taken aback at the notion that anyone might not value his lordship to the same degree that she did, but after a moment's lip-pursing, allowed as this might be so.
He wasn't in his uniform, was he, ma'am? She asked me, brow furrowed.
I shook my head. John didn't hold an active commission. He was a diplomat, though technically still lieutenant colonel of his brother's regiment, and therefore wore his uniform for purposes of ceremony or intimidation. But he was officially retired from the army, not a combatant, and in plain clothes he would be taken as citizen rather than soldier, thus of no particular interest to General Washington's troops at Valley Forge. I didn't think Jamie was headed for Valley Forge in any case. I knew with absolute certainty that he would come back. Here. For me. The thought bloomed low in my belly and spread upward in a wave of warmth that made me bury my nose in my teacup to hide the resulting flush. Alive. I caressed the word, cradling it in the centre of my heart. Jamie was alive. Glad as I was to see Jenny, and gladder still to see her extend an olive branch in my direction, I really wanted to go up to my room, close the door, and lean against the wall with my eyes shut tight, reliving the seconds after he'd entered the room, when he'd taken me in his arms and pressed me to the wall, kissing me. The simple, solid, warm fact of his presence so overwhelming that I might have collapsed on the floor without that wall's support. Alive, I repeated silently to myself. He's alive. Nothing else mattered. Though I did wonder briefly what he'd done with John. Chapter 4.
Don't ask questions you don't want to hear the answers to.
In the woods, an hour's ride outside Philadelphia. John Gray had been quite resigned to dying. Had expected it from the moment that he'd blurted out, "I've had carnal knowledge of your wife." The only question in his mind had been whether Fraser would shoot him, stab him, or eviscerate him with his bare hands. To have the injured husband regard him calmly and say merely, "Oh, why?" was not merely unexpected, but infamous. Absolutely infamous.
Why? John Gray repeated, incredulous. Did you say, why?
I did. And I should appreciate an answer.
Now that Gray had both eyes open, he could see that Fraser's outward calm was not quite so impervious as he'd first supposed. There was a pulse beating in Fraser's temple, and he'd shifted his weight a little, like a man might do in the vicinity of a tavern brawl, not quite ready to commit violence, but readying himself to meet it. Perversely, Grey found this sight steadying.
"What do you bloody mean, why?" he said, suddenly irritated. "And why aren't you fucking dead?"
"I often wonder that myself," Fraser replied politely.
"I take it you thought I was."
"Yes, and so did your wife."
"Do you have the faintest idea what the knowledge of your death did to her?"
The dark blue eyes narrowed just a trifle.
"Are you implying that the news of my death deranged her to such an extent that she lost her reason and took ye to her bed by force? Because," he went on, neatly cutting off Grey's heated reply, "unless I've been seriously misled regarding your own nature, it would take substantial force to compel ye to any such action. Or am I wrong?"
The eyes stayed narrow. Grey stared back at them. Then he closed his own eyes briefly and rubbed both hands hard over his face, like a man waking from a nightmare. He dropped his hands and opened his eyes again.
"You are not misled," he said through clenched teeth. "And you are wrong."
Fraser's ruddy eyebrows shot up in genuine astonishment, Grey thought.
"You went to her because... from desire?"
His voice rose too.
"And she let you? I dinna believe it."
The colour was creeping up Fraser's tanned neck, vivid as a climbing rose. Grey had seen that happen before, and decided recklessly that the best, the only defence, was to lose his own temper first. It was a relief.
"We thought you were dead, you bloody asshole," he said, furious. "Both of us. Dead. And we took too much to drink one night, very much too much. We spoke of you, and, damn you, neither one of us was making love to the other. We were both fucking you."
Fraser's face went abruptly blank, and his jaw dropped. Grey enjoyed one split second of satisfaction at the sight, before a massive fist came up hard beneath his ribs, and he hurtled backward, staggered a few steps farther, and fell. He lay in the leaves, completely winded, mouth opening and closing like an automaton's.
"All right, then," he thought dimly. "Bare hands it is."
The hands wrapped themselves in his shirt and jerked him to his feet. He managed to stand, and a wisp of air seeped into his lungs. Fraser's face was an inch from his. Fraser was, in fact, so close that Grey couldn't see the man's expression. Only a close-up view of two bloodshot blue eyes, both of them berserk. That was enough. He felt quite calm now. It wouldn't take long.
"You tell me exactly what happened, you filthy wee pervert," Fraser whispered, his breath hot on Grey's face and smelling of ale.
He shook Grey slightly.
"Every word, every motion, everything."
Grey got just enough breath to answer.
"No,"
he said definitely.
"Go ahead and kill me."
Fraser shook him violently so that his teeth clacked painfully together and he bit his tongue. He made a strangled noise at this, and a blow that he hadn't seen coming struck him in the left eye. He fell down again, his head exploding with fractured colour and black dots. The smell of leaf mould pungent in his nose. Fraser yanked him up and set him on his feet once more, but then paused, presumably deciding how best to continue the process of vivisection. What with the blood pounding in his ears and the rasp of Fraser's breath, Grey hadn't heard anything, but when he cautiously opened his good eye to see where the next blow was coming from, he saw the man. A rough-looking, dirty thug in a fringed hunting shirt gawping stupidly from under a tree.
"Jethro!"
the man bellowed, taking a tighter hold on the gun he carried. A number of men came out of the bushes. One or two had the rudiments of a uniform, but most of them were dressed in homespun, though with the addition of the bizarre liberty caps, tight-knitted woollen affairs that fitted over the head and ears, which, through John's watering eye, gave the men the bluntly menacing aspect of animated bombshells. The wives who had presumably made these garments had knitted such mottos as liberty or freedom into the bands, though one bloodthirsty Abigail had knitted the adjuration kill into her husband's hat. The husband in question was, Grey noted, a small and weedy specimen, wearing spectacles with one shattered lens. Fraser had stopped at the sound of the men's approach, and now rounded on them like a bear brought to bay by hounds. The hounds stopped abruptly, at a safe distance. Grey pressed a hand over his liver, which he thought had likely been ruptured, and panted. He was going to need what breath he could get.
"Who are you?" one of the men demanded, jabbing pugnaciously at Jamie with the end of a long stick.
"Colonel James Fraser, Morgan's Rifles,"
Fraser replied coldly, ignoring the stick.
"And you?"
The man appeared somewhat disconcerted, but covered it with bluster.
"Corporal Jethro Woodbine, Dunning's Rangers," he said, very gruff.
He jerked his head at his companions, who at once spread out in a businesslike way surrounding the clearing.
"Who's your prisoner, then?"
Grey felt his stomach tighten, which, given the condition of his liver, hurt. He replied through clenched teeth, not waiting for Jamie.
"I am Lord John Grey, if it's any business of yours."
His mind was hopping like a flea, trying to calculate whether his chances of survival were better with Jamie Fraser or with this gang of yahoos. A few moments before, he had been resigned to the idea of death at Jamie's hands, but like many ideas, that one was more appealing in concept than in execution. The revelation of his identity seemed to confuse the men, who squinted and murmured, glancing at him dubiously.
"He ain't got a uniform on," one observed to another, sotto voce. "Be he a soldier at all? We got no business with him if we ain't, do we?"
"Yes, we do,"
Woodbine declared, regaining some of his self-confidence.
"And if Colonel Fraser's taken him prisoner, I reckon he has reason."
His voice went up, reluctantly questioning. Jamie made no reply, his eyes fixed on Grey.
"He's a soldier,"
Head swung around to see who'd spoken. It was the small man with shattered spectacles who had adjusted these with one hand, the better to peer at Grey through his remaining lens. A watery blue eye inspected Grey, then the man nodded, more certain.
"He's a soldier," the man repeated. "I saw him in Philadelphia, sitting on the porch of a house on Chestnut Street, in his uniform, large as life." "He's an officer,"
he added unnecessarily.
"He is not a soldier," Fraser said,
and turned his head to fix the spectacled man with a firm eye.
"Saw him," muttered the man, "plain as day. Bad gold braid," he murmured almost inaudibly, dropping his eyes.
"Hmph."
Jethro Woodbine approached Grey, examining him carefully.
"Well, you got anything to say for yourself, Lord Grey?"
"Lord John,"
Grey said crossly, and brushed a fragment of crushed leaf off his tongue.
"I'm not a peer. My elder brother is. Grey is my family name. As for being a soldier, I have been. I still bear rank within my regiment, but my commission is not active. Is that sufficient, or do you want to know what I had for breakfast this morning?"
He was purposely antagonizing them, some part of him having decided that he would rather go with Woodbine and bear the inspection of the Continentals than remain here to face the further inspections of Jamie Fraser. Fraser was regarding him through narrowed eyes. He fought the urge to look away.
"It's the truth," he thought defiantly. "What I told you is the truth, and now you know it."
"Yes," said Fraser's black gaze. "You think I will live quietly with it?"
"He is not a soldier,"
Fraser repeated, turning his back deliberately on Grey, switching his attention to Woodbine.
"He is my prisoner, because I wish to question him."
"About what?"
"That is not your concern, Mr. Woodbine," Jamie said,
deep voice soft but edged with steel. Jethro Woodbine, though, was nobody's fool, and meant to make that clear.
"I'll be judge of what's my business, sir,"
he added, with a notable pause.
"How do we know you're who you say you are, eh? You aren't in uniform. Any of you fellows know this man?"
The fellows, thus addressed, looked surprised. They looked uncertainly at one another. One or two heads shook in the negative.
"Well, then," said Woodbine, emboldened, "if you can't prove who you are, then I think we'll take this man back to camp for questioning."
He smiled unpleasantly, another thought having evidently occurred to him.
"Think we ought to take you, too?"
Fraser stood quite still for a moment, breathing slowly, and regarding Woodbine as a tiger might regard a hedgehog.
Yes, he could eat it, but would the inconvenience of swallowing be worth it? "Take him, then," he said abruptly, stepping back from Grey. "I have business elsewhere."
Woodbine had been expecting argument. He blinked disconcerted, and half raised his stick, but said nothing as Fraser stalked toward the far edge of the clearing. Just under the trees, Fraser turned and gave Grey a flat, dark look.
"We are not finished, sir," he said.
Grey pulled himself upright, disregarding both the pain in his liver and the tears leaking from his damaged eye.
"At your service, sir," he snapped.
Fraser glared at him and moved into the flickering green shadows, completely disregarding Woodbine and his men. One or two of them glanced at the corporal, whose face showed his indecision. Grey didn't share it. Just before Fraser's tall silhouette vanished for good, he cupped his hands to his mouth.
"I'm not bloody sorry," he bellowed.
Chapter 5. The Passions of Young Men. While fascinated to hear about William and the dramatic circumstances under which he had just discovered his paternity, Jenny's true concern was for another young man. "Do you ken where young Ian is?" she asked eagerly. "And did he find his young woman, the Quaker lassie he told his da about?" I relaxed a little at this. Young Ian and Rachel Hunter were, thank God, not on the list of fraught situations. At least, not for the moment. "He did," I said, smiling. "As for where he is, I haven't seen him for several days, but he's often gone for longer. He scouts for the Continental Army now and then, though since they've been in their winter quarters at Valley Forge for so long, there's been less need for scouting. He spends quite a bit of time there, though, because Rachel does." Jenny blinked at that. "She does? Why? Do Quakers not mislike wars and such?" "Well, more or less. But her brother, Denzel, is an army surgeon, though he's a real physician, not the usual horse-leech or quacksalver the army usually gets. And he's been at Valley Forge since last November. Rachel comes and goes to Philadelphia. She can pass through the pickets, so she carries back food and supplies. But she works with Denny, so she's out there helping with patients much more often than she is here." "Tell me about her," Jenny said, leaning forward intently. "Is she a good lass? And you think she loves young Ian? From what Ian told me, the lad's desperate in love with her, but hadn't spoken to her yet, not knowing how she'd take it. He wasn't as sure she could deal with him being what he is." Her quick gesture encompassed young Ian's history and character from Highland lad to Mohawk warrior. "God kens weel he'll never make a decent Quaker, and I expect young Ian kens that too." I laughed at the thought, though in fact the issue might be serious. I didn't know what a Quaker meeting might think of such a match, but I rather thought they might view the prospect with alarm. I knew nothing about Quaker marriage, though. "She's a very good girl," I assured Jenny. "Extremely sensible, very capable, and plainly in love with Ian. Though I don't think she's told him so, either."
"Ah.
Do you ken her parents?"
"No,
they both died when she was a child. She was mostly raised by a Quaker widow, and then came to keep house for her brother when she was 16 or so.
"That little Quaker girl?"
Mrs. Fig had come in with a vase of summer roses smelling of myrrh and sugar. Jenny inhaled strongly and sat up straight.
"Mercy Woodcock thinks the world of her. She comes by Mercy's house every time she's in town to visit that young man."
"A young man?" Jenny asked, dark brows drawing together. "William's cousin, Henry," I hastened to explain. "Denzel and I carried out a very serious operation on him during the winter. Rachel knows both William and Henry, and is very kind about visiting to see how Henry is. Mrs. Woodcock is his landlady." It occurred to me that I had meant to go check on Henry today myself. There were rumours of a British withdrawal from the city, and I needed to see whether he was fit enough yet to travel. He was doing well when I'd stopped by a week before, but at that point had been able to walk only a few steps, leaning on Mercy Woodcock's arm. "What about Mercy Woodcock?" I wondered with a small jolt at the pit of the stomach. It was clear to me, as it was to John, that there was a serious and deepening affection between the free black woman and her aristocratic young lodger. I had met Mercy's husband, very badly wounded, during the exodus from Fort Ticonderoga a year before, and, lacking any communication from or about him, thought it very likely that he had died after being taken prisoner by the British. Still, the possibility of Walter Woodcock returning miraculously from the dead, people did, after all, and a fresh bubble of joy rose under my heart at the thought, was the least of the matter. I couldn't imagine that John's brother, the very firm-minded Duke of Pardlow, would be delighted at hearing that his youngest son meant to marry the widow of a carpenter, whatever her colour. And then there was his daughter, Dotty. Speaking of Quakers, she was betrothed to Denzel Hunter, and I did wonder what the Duke would think of that. John, who liked a wager, had given me no better than even odds between Dotty and her father. I shook my head, dismissing the dozen things I could do nothing about. During this minor reverie, Jenny and Mrs. Fig appeared to have been discussing William and his abrupt departure from the scene.
"Where would he go to, I wonder?"
Mrs. Fig looked worriedly toward the wall of the stairwell, pocked with blood-smeared dents left by William's fist. "Gone to find a bottle? A fight? Or a woman?" said Jenny, with the authority of a wife, a sister, and the mother of sons. "Maybe all three." Elfrith Alley. It was past midday, and the only voices in the house were the distant chitterings of women. No one was visible in the parlour as they passed, and no one appeared as the girl led William up a foot-marked staircase to her room. It gave him an odd feeling, as though he might be invisible. He found the notion a comfort. He couldn't bear himself. She went in before him and threw open the shutters. He wanted to tell her to close them. He felt wretchedly exposed in the flood of sunlight. But it was summer. The room was hot and airless, and he was already sweating heavily. Air swirled in, heavy with the odour of tree sap and recent rain, and the sun glowed briefly on the smooth top of her head, like the gloss on a fresh conker. She turned and smiled at him. "First things first," she announced briskly. "Throw off your coat and waistcoat before you suffocate." Not waiting to see whether he would take the suggestion, she turned to reach for the basin and ewer. She filled the basin and stepped back, motioning him towards the washstand where a towel and a much-used sliver of soap stood on worn wood. "I'll fetch us a drink, shall I?" And with that she was gone, bare feet pattering busily down the stairs. Mechanically, he began to undress. He blinked stupidly at the basin, but then recalled that in the better sort of house, sometimes a man was required to wash his parts first. He'd encountered the custom once before, but on that occasion the whore had performed the ablution for him, plying the soap to such effect that the first encounter had ended right there, in the wash-basin. The memory made the blood flame up in his face again, and he ripped at his flies, popping off a button. He was still throbbing all over, but the sensation was becoming more centralized. His hands were unsteady, and he cursed under his breath, reminded by the broken skin on his knuckles of his unceremonious exit from his father's... No, not his bloody father's house. Lord John's.
You bloody bastard,
he said under his breath. You knew. You knew all along. That infuriated him almost more than the horrifying revelation of his own paternity. His stepfather, whom he'd loved, whom he'd trusted more than anyone on earth, Lord John Bloody Grey, had lied to him his whole life. Everyone had lied to him. Everyone. He felt suddenly as though he'd broken through a crust of frozen snow and plunged straight down into an unsuspected river beneath. Swept away into black breathlessness beneath the ice, helpless, voiceless, a feral chill clawing at his heart. There was a small sound behind him, and he whirled by instinct, aware only when he saw the young whore's appalled face that he was weeping savagely, tears running down his own face, and his wet, half-hard cock flopping out of his breeches.
"Go away," he croaked, making a frantic effort to tuck himself in.
She didn't go away, but came toward him, decanter in one hand, and a pair of pewter cups in the other.
"Are you all right?" she asked, eyeing him sideways. "Here, let me pour you a drink. You can tell me all about it."
"No."
She came on toward him, but more slowly. Through his swimming eyes, he saw the twitch of her mouth as she saw his cock.
"I meant the water for your poor hands," she said, clearly trying not to laugh. "I will say as you're a real gentleman, though."
"I'm not."
She blinked.
"Is it an insult to call you a gentleman?"
Overcome with fury at the word, he lashed out blindly, knocking the decanter from her hand. It burst in a spray of glass and cheap wine, and she cried out as the red soaked through her petticoat.
"You bastard!" she shrieked, and drawing back her arm, threw the cups at his head.
She didn't hit him, and they clanged and rolled away across the floor. She was turning toward the door, crying out, "Ned! Ned!" when he lunged and caught her. He only wanted to stop her shrieking, stop her bringing up whatever male enforcement the house employed. He got a hand on her mouth, yanking her back from the door, grappling one-handed to try to control her flailing arms.
"I'm sorry.
I'm sorry," he kept saying.
"I didn't mean... I don't mean..."
"Oh, bloody hell!"
She caught him abruptly in the nose with her elbow, and he let go, backing away with a hand to his face, blood dripping through his fingers. Her face was marked with red where he'd held her, and her eyes were wild. She backed away, scrubbing at her mouth with the back of her hand.
"Get out!" she gasped.
He didn't need telling twice.
He rushed past her, shouldered his way past a burly man charging up the stairs, and ran down the alley, realizing only when he reached the street that he was in his shirt sleeves, having left coat and waistcoat behind, and his breeches were undone.
"Ellesmere," said an appalled voice nearby.
He looked up in horror to find himself the cynosure of several English officers, including Alexander Lindsay.
"Good Christ, Ellesmere, what happened?"
Sandy was by way of being a friend, and was already pulling a voluminous snowy handkerchief from his sleeve. He clapped this to William's nose, pinching his nostrils, and insisting that he put his head back.
"Have you been set upon and wobbed?" one of the others demanded. "God, this filthy place."
He felt at once comforted by their company, and hideously embarrassed by it. He was not one of them, not any longer.
"Was it? Was it robbery?" another said, glaring round eagerly. "We'll find the bastards who did it, 'pon my honour we will. We'll get your property back and teach whoever did it a lesson."
Blood was running down the back of his throat, harsh and iron-tasting, and he coughed, but did his best to nod and shrug simultaneously. He had been robbed, but no one was ever going to give him back what he'd lost today. Chapter 6 Under My Protection. The bell of the Presbyterian church 2 blocks away rang for 2:30, and my stomach echoed it, reminding me that, what with one thing and another, I hadn't had any tea yet. Jenny had had a bite with Masali and the children, but declared herself equal to dealing with an egg if there might be one. So I sent Mrs. Fig to see whether there might, and within 20 minutes we were wallowing, in a genteel fashion, in soft-boiled eggs, fried sardines, and, for lack of cake, flapjacks with butter and honey, which Jenny had never seen before, but took to with the greatest alacrity. "Look how it soaks up the sweetness," she exclaimed, pressing the spongy little cake with a fork, then releasing it. "Nay like a bannock at all." She glanced over her shoulder, then leaned toward me, lowering her voice. "Do you think Herd in the kitchen might shew me the way of it, if I asked?" A diffident rapping on the damaged front door interrupted her, and as I turned to look, it was shoved open, and a long shadow fell across the painted canvas rug, narrowly preceding its owner. A young British subaltern peered into the parlour, looking disconcerted by the wreckage in the foyer. "Lieutenant Colonel Grey?" he asked, hopefully, glancing back and forth between Jenny and me. "His lordship isn't in just now," I said, attempting to sound self-possessed. I wondered just how many more times I might have to say that, and to whom. "Oh." The young man looked further disconcerted. "Can you tell me where he is, Mum? Colonel Graves sent a message earlier, asking Lieutenant Colonel Grey to attend General Clinton at once, and the General was, rather wondering why the Lieutenant Colonel hadn't arrived yet." "Ah," I said, with a sideways glance at Jenny. "Well, I'm afraid his lordship was rather urgently called away before he received the Colonel's message." That must have been the paper John had received moments before Jamie's dramatic reappearance from a watery grave. He'd glanced at it, but then shoved it unread into his breeches pocket. The soldier heaved a small sigh at this, but was undaunted. "Yes, Mum. If you'll tell me where his lordship is, I'll go fetch him there. I really can't go back without him, you know." He gave me a woeful look, though, with a touch of a charming smile. I smiled back with a small touch of panic in my midsection. "I'm so sorry, but I really don't know where he is right now," I said, standing up in hopes of driving him back toward the door. "Well, Mum, if you'll just tell me where he was heading, I shall go there and seek direction," he said, doggedly standing his ground. "He didn't tell me." I took a step toward him, but he didn't retreat. This was escalating beyond absurdity into something more serious. I'd met General Clinton briefly at the Mischianza ball a few weeks ago. God, had it been only weeks? It seemed whole lifetimes, and while he'd been quite cordial to me, I didn't think he'd receive a nolle prosequi from me with any sort of complacence. Generals tended to think highly of their own consequence. "You know his lordship doesn't hold an active commission," I said in the faint hope of putting the young man off. He looked surprised. "Yes, he does, Mum. The colonel sent notice of it with the message this morning." "What? He can't do that, can he?" I asked, a sudden dread creeping up my backbone. "Do what, Mum?" Just tell his lordship that his commission is active." "Oh, no, Mum," he assured me. "The colonel of Lieutenant Colonel Grey's regiment recalled him. The Duke of Partlow." "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said, sitting down. Jenny snapped.